The second case for oral argument this morning is Chance Glenn Haruf, appellant versus the state of South Dakota. Lee, for the appellant, we have Ms. Raleigh Hansman and Mr. Clint Sargent. And Ms. Hansman, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes, sir.
All right. And for the state, we have Mr. Quincy Kierstead, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Justice Devaney has disqualified herself on this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable David Knopf, a circuit judge from the First Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Devaney's place. With that, Ms. Hansman, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. In opening statements, Chance Haruf told the jury that he and Christy Olson were in a volatile, tumultuous, mutually abusive relationship. He didn't sugarcoat the couple's issues. He didn't sanitize the relationship. That afternoon, the state called Gaylynn Berry and Samantha York to testify at length to Haruf and Olson's relationship, including incidents of physical and verbal abuse, Olson's fear of Haruf and desire to end the relationship, and Haruf's anger and jealousy. Additionally, both witnesses' testimony, including reading aloud from text message conversations between themselves and Olson, memorializing these sentiments and these stories. All 13 exhibits of text messages were admitted into evidence. By the end of day one, through Haruf's own admissions and the testimony of Gaylynn Berry, Samantha York, and the exhibits, all of the reasons the trial court had cited for admitting other acts evidence, fear, abuse, jealousy, relationship context, had been accomplished by the state. The relationship picture had been painted, but the state was not done painting. Over Haruf's objection, the trial court allowed the state to call Marissa Bridges, Kristen Wallace, and Melvin Vosica to rehash and repeat other acts evidence already in the record to bookend its case in chief. Melvin Vosica, Marissa Bridges, and Kristen Wallace's testimony is most appropriately characterized prohibited propensity evidence.
Well, if the evidence is already in the record, what prejudice did your client suffer by having this 404B evidence come in? Isn't it just cumulative?
It is cumulative, Your Honor. However, it's not just run-of-the-mill cumulative evidence. We're talking about 404B prohibited character evidence. 404A and 404B1 prohibit evidence coming into the record that simply is about character.
Well, Ms. Hansman, though, I'm understanding you're not challenging in the first instance the relevance of the 404B. You're just saying it was too much, as you know, so there's initial relevance for it. Court determined that. I don't see you arguing it's not relevant here on appeal. So you're arguing it's too prejudicial because the relevance started going down as more and more witnesses were called, and so pretty soon the prejudice is essentially greater than the relevance. Is that fair?
That is my argument, yes, Your Honor.
So then if that's the case, so even if we get to the point of saying, okay, yeah, right, the prejudicial value substantially outweighed the probative value after the fifth witness, the evidence is in, how do you get to prejudice in terms of establishing a right to a new trial that it probably would have made a difference in the outcome of the case? You've already got two or three witnesses talking about it, so you have a couple more witnesses come in. Does it really affect the probability that verdict was different because of that?
It does, Your Honor. As I was just responding to the Chief Justice, we're not talking about run-of-the-mill cumulative evidence. We're talking about cumulative other acts evidence, evidence that is talking then specifically about character, which this court has consistently held is not proper before a jury.
Let me make sure I understand how I read the brief and also your answer to Justice Jensen's question. I read this second issue or is to be a Rule 403 balancing 403 sort of quantum of evidence argument. In other words, there was too much of it, and it eclipsed the standard in 403. But I don't see it as being an argument, you tell me if I'm wrong, that the 404B analysis was itself wrong. In other words, I see your argument as, you know, this probably was okay under 404B, but there was just too much of it. and in that way violated Rule 403. Is that right or is that wrong?
That is correct, Your Honor. We're not disputing that under 404B, the evidence in a vacuum would have been acceptable. It's when it starts being stacked one on top of another.
The reason I ask, though, is because when you start talking about the evidence here being 404B evidence and being pure propensity evidence and things like that, 404B contemplates that the other act's evidence is admissible for another purpose. So, but to be clear, you're not saying that the 404B evidence violated that rule, just that it violated 403.
In essence, we're saying both, Your Honor. The argument is more twofold, at least in my mind. So perhaps this can provide a little bit of clarity for the court. The argument is that it is cumulative. It violates 403.
Yeah.
And so when it violates 403, it becomes substantially prejudicial to my client and then impaired his fair trial rights. But beyond that, Your Honor, when we have a cumulative presentation of other acts evidence, it crosses the threshold to becoming 404A evidence, improper character evidence.
So once you get to that, I think I understand your argument now. So once you get to that and you go beyond the sweet spot of Rule 403, you're otherwise permissible 404B evidence becomes impermissible in its quantity and therefore becomes more propensity style?
Correct.
You've got to win on your 403 argument before we would reach a 404B argument.
Yes, they're very closely intertwined, Your Honor.
I'm with you. Thank you.
The cumulative effect of the introduction of the 404B evidence rises to that level of violating not only 403, but 404A and 404B1. This is the type of evidence that transforms a trial from being about what someone is accused to have done to being about who somebody is as a person. Once this transformation occurred, Harif was impossible to receive a fair trial. Harif's second-degree murder conviction is the product of this constitutional violation, and it's the reason why his conviction should be vacated and this matter to be remanded for a new trial. It's important for the court to keep in mind that Chance Harif was acquitted on first-degree murder. He was found guilty on the alternate charge of second-degree murder. According to statute, second-degree murder is a lesser-included offense of first-degree murder, but it isn't a lesser in the sense that it includes fewer elements. This court has acknowledged that second-degree murder requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt of an additional mens rea, the depravity of mind. A depraved mind requirement is an additional element that the state must establish beyond a reasonable doubt to move forward on second-degree murder. Second-degree murder is a standalone homicide offense. It carries a heavy but different evidentiary burden. To meet second-degree murder's burden, the state must prove depravity of mind from the conduct itself and the circumstances of its commission. Depraved mind murder has never been the state's theory. There's no evidence offered by the state to depravity of mind. All the evidence the state offered was for murder one, the charge for which Chance Harif is acquitted. This is an important distinction because states across the country have held that depraved mind murder is not a substitute for deliberate intent murder. It is not a fallback position when the state fails to prove deliberation.
All right, counsel, would you please address the court's holding in State versus Libel, in which we rejected a very similar argument in 1999 and then followed it in State versus Mulligan in 2007, where we said that the mere fact that a defendant is convicted of one account isn't necessarily evidence that they should be acquitted on another, and that what appellate courts should do is analyze the sufficiency of the evidence. How do you deal with Libel and Mulligan, where we have rejected this argument?
Your Honor, I agree with the analysis you're bringing forward, and I agree the court needs to be looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, and that's where I was actually headed next. The sufficiency of the evidence presents an interesting problem here. Our first position is that there is not evidence of depravity of mind, that additional mens rea that is introduced by the state. However, beyond that, all of the cumulative 404B other acts evidence that came in through Marissa Bridges, Melvin Vosika, and Kristen Wallace poisoned all of the evidence in the record. So both the absence of evidence as well as the improper evidence that was admitted establishes that evidentiary insufficiency in this case.
So I'm still struggling with this. How do we as an appellate court, what do you have, like five witnesses given 404B testimony? Is that right? Were there five or six witnesses?
There would have been six, Your Honor.
Okay. So how do we as an appellate court reviewing this, giving abuse of discretion to the trial court, say, well, you know, the second witness, I mean, it's all prior act, it's all domestic abuse evidence, different instances, some of the same instances in some occasion. How do we say at this point, well, okay, witness number three, that was too much? I mean, are you asking us to draw some sort of bright line or something that says, you know, this is just too much once you have two witnesses or three witnesses or four witnesses? Tell me how you address that issue. For us as an appellate court reviewing abuse of discretion standard.
For you as an appellate court reviewing abuse of discretion in a case dealing with 404B other acts evidence, especially in a homicide case, this needs to be done on a case-by-case basis. My argument isn't one dealing with volume. I'm not here saying that simply because there were three witnesses or four or five that testified to other acts evidence, that's where it became too many. Our position is that it became too much when the state put on Marissa Bridges, Kristen Wallace, and Melvin Vosika to bookend its case in chief. You just mentioned that those witnesses would have testified to maybe some of the same but different incidents.
What would happen if they had been put on first?
The error would still be in the record, Your Honor. And the reason is when you look at what was actually testified to go through a breakdown of what each witness said and how it is a repeat, a rehashing of evidence already in the record. For example, Galen Berry testified on the first day of trial, as well as read from text messages, about the purchase, placement, and rationale for a baby monitor. 2 days later, when Marissa Bridges is called to testify, she testifies to the purchase, placement, and rationale for a baby monitor.
Isn't she the person that actually put the baby monitor in the room and then observed it to be unplugged several days later? So that would be new evidence, or excuse me, additional evidence surrounding that issue?
It's still the same sequence of events. The reason it came in was still to establish the same issues. And she still discussed that it had been purchased, why it had been purchased. We would contend that there was not any additional probative value as to the relationship itself that was provided by that testimony from Marissa Bridges, that it was simply a repeat of that of what Galen had already shared with the court and which had already been admitted into evidence through the text message exhibits.
So how could we look at that and say, you know, in the absence of those three witnesses, we really think the result would have been different here? I mean, what suggests that on the record here? If even if we were to accept your evidentiary argument and determine abuse discretion exists in this case, how can we look at this and say this record and say, you know, I think without those three witnesses, this result might have been different. We really don't have confidence in it. What is there about this record that suggests that and that points us in that direction?
What's in this record is the repeat of the specific evidence. Besides Galen Berry, we also have testimony from Samantha York. She testified to her belief that Chance was drugging her. Kristen Wallace, 2 days later, then testifies to that same information. We then have Melvin Vosika. He is the third witness called by the state right before they end their case in chief that solely testifies on this other act evidence. And he testifies generically, saying that Christy was abused and she was afraid of Chance. And then there's a text message substantiating that. All of that evidence pushes it into being improper character evidence, which this court has consistently ruled is improper to come in before a jury.
But my question is slightly different. Even if we were to accept the argument that as an evidentiary matter, this was wrong, and there's an abuse of discretion, we have an additional inquiry that we have to undertake, and that is that it compromised the result in some way, and that there's prejudice. Where's that, and how can we determine that from the record?
Aside from just the evidence itself, other ways to determine...
Yeah, I mean, the introduction of the evidence might be an abuse of discretion. It doesn't necessarily create self-evident proof of prejudice. There has to be something else out there that suggests to us as an appellate court, yeah, this was wrong and it really mattered. It really mattered in this case. It might have made a difference.
I would say the best way for the court to maybe formulate that idea, to take into consideration not just the evidence in the record, but the law as it stands under 404A, 404B1, and then our accumulation argument, 403, is actually a conversation that I had with my husband while I was preparing for this. And he had a very similar question to Your Honor. And my husband is not legally trained at all. He just lives with a lawyer. But after reading the briefs, he said the same thing. You know, what did it matter? He said when he read it, he looked at it as an ice cream sundae, and that you have your ice cream, your whipped topping, some chocolate, and then you throw on sprinkles. And sprinkles don't really make it or break it. They're just there. And my response to him and my response to the court would be, we don't have sprinkles here. We have nuts, and there's a nut allergy. And even though it seems minimal, it seems like it's not that big a deal, it poisons everything. So the only way you can get rid of that adverse consequence is a completely new bowl, to start from scratch, or in this case, a completely new trial.
So what would we tell the trial court to do differently next time around if we sent it back for a new trial?
You would tell the court that after the testimony of Galen Berry and Samantha York, that unless there's additional probative value on the relationship context or the other incidents that the court said was acceptable under 404B, that evidence could not come in at trial. Another thing to point out that adds to the substantial prejudice that occurred in this trial is a discussion on the cautionary instruction that was provided by the court. It's something the state actually mentioned in its brief as curing this cumulative effect that we're here talking about. Now, the trial court did note in its findings of fact and conclusions of law that it intended to give a cautionary instruction to mitigate any potential prejudice from accumulation. Now, on the first day of trial, Galen Berry testified, and at the close of her evidence, the court read a cautionary instruction telling the jury it could only be considered for limited purpose. Samantha York testified. At the conclusion of her testimony, the same instruction read. But when you fast forward a few days, Marissa Bridges testifies, the cumulative other acts evidence, no instruction is read. Kristen Wallace then testifies, solely on 404B evidence. No instruction is read. It isn't until the third witness in a row testifying solely to other acts evidence that cautionary instruction is read.
Did the circuit court deny your request to read the cautionary instruction after every one of those? Or did you not request it?
That request wasn't discussed. The plan and the protocol as it started out at the trial was to read it after each witness.
So
that didn't occur on day three.
If part of your argument contemplates that the circuit court made and it abused its discretion by not giving that cautionary instruction, is that issue even preserved in the absence of request by the defense to give it?
I would say it's still preserved under the totality of everything that needs to be considered here.
Isn't there a risk that the instruction would be overly emphasized if it was read? Well, that would have been read five times rather than three.
And, Your Honor, that's always a concern for either side, that it draws additional attention to it. But here, at the point where the state called those three additional witnesses who testified solely to other acts right before they closed their case in chief, the lack of interruption with that cautionary instruction just let that evidence build and build and build. The absence of that cautionary instruction in between there strengthened that propensity evidence and adds to the prejudicial nature of it coming in at trial.
What if the trial court had only given it once at the end of the case along with the other instructions?
It would be our position that it would still not have been enough.
Do we have any case to support that? That we have to read it every time or more than once?
No, There isn't a bright line rule that requires the court to read it every time or to only read it once. It's completely at the trial court's discretion, and courts across the country have acknowledged that. But our position here is that based on how it was done on day one, the failure to do it on day three, when it's a repeat of other acts evidence, when it's right at the end, and when it's one witness after another, added to the level of prejudice that my client suffered. The court obviously appreciates the serious nature of this case and the consequences, or we wouldn't be here. As the court well knows, there's only a few lawyers in the state who handle homicide cases, much less try them. We rely on the decisions this court makes when we advise our clients and make decisions at trial. When we make errors as attorneys, our clients can suffer with their lives and with their freedoms. But the same thing happens when the trial court makes an error and fails to provide its gatekeeping function. The trial court abused its discretion in allowing Marissa Bridges, Kristen Wallace, and Melvin Vosika to rehash and repeat other acts evidence already in the record.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Kierstead, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This court should affirm the second-degree murder conviction of Chance Haroff because, one, sufficient evidence exists in the record to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that all the elements of second-degree murder were proven, and two, the circuit court properly allowed three witnesses to testify to Haroff's other acts, finding that testimony not cumulative. Now, Haroff murdered Christy on May 31st, 2017. As my friend on the other side said, this was a volatile and violent relationship from the beginning. Christy told her family and friends of this abuse, both physical and verbal. Whether it was being slapped in front of her kids as they bathed, or being slapped at a hospital, she recovered from surgery. Or on the day after Chris being choked, all for a text message that Christy received saying Merry Christmas from one of the fathers of her children. Now Christy always had her phone on her, and that day Haroff took it and threw it in a wood stove. Now, as the violence escalated, Christy began to fear Haroff. She asked her mom, Galen, to buy a baby monitor. And Marissa Bridges placed that baby monitor in Christy's room, just in case she'd be able to call for help. Christy's fears were realized on May 31st, 2017. Haroff and Christy travel from Sioux Falls. They get home to Christy's home in Dallas. They argue. Haroff leaves in a fury. Later that night, Christy vents to her daughter, Samantha, and Marissa. She's annoyed, and she just wants the relationship to end. The next morning, Christy's lifeless body is found in her room, unresponsive and cold. Her children frantically call 911, and despite emergency responders' best efforts, they cannot resuscitate her. Now, staff at the hospital notice abrasions and discoloration on Christy's neck, and they report it to law enforcement. Law enforcement, in turn, tells Dr. Kenneth Snell about these abrasions. And he comes to two conclusions, that the cause of Christy's death was asphyxia by manual strangulation, and that her manner of death was not an accident, it was a homicide. Law enforcement early on learns of this violent relationship between Chance and Christie, and they interview him. Where were you that night? He denies ever going to Dallas, says he talked to her about 2:45 a.m. that night on the phone. We heard evidence otherwise. Surveillance videos around Gregory saw Harif coming in from the direction of Dallas around 4 a.m. that night. Now, Christie's phone pinged at Gregory around 4 a.m. Harif had it. He placed it in a dumpster behind a closed gas station in Gregory and returned to his apartment. Armed with this information, law enforcement approaches Harif again. Where were you last night? They give him a chance to tell the truth. He lies again. They confront him with information that of the surveillance videos and Christie's phone. He then slowly admits, I did travel to Dallas that night, I did take Christie's phone, and I hit her with an open palm. She went to one knee and slammed the door in retaliation. Then I simply left.
So Mr. Kierstead, if I could interrupt you for a moment right there, what evidence exists in the record that you believe satisfies the element of second-degree murder that requires an act imminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind, which seems to be at the heart of Hansen's sufficiency of the evidence argument? Where can we look and what evidence exists in the record that would support that element?
Well, certainly the jury was instructed on what do we look at?
No objection to any of the instructions on that, right?
Okay. No.
Okay, so we got the rules right. Tell me what exists in the record that would give us confidence that there is substantial evidence on that element, which is what we're looking for in a sufficiency of evidence review.
Well, and certainly it's looking at the act and the circumstances around the commission of that act. So look at Dr. Snell's testimony. There were abrasions on Christie's neck. And what was important about those abrasions is directly beneath, there was acute hemorrhaging, acute being fresh wounds to the internal neck musculature of Christie. And how did these wounds occur? Dr. Kenneth Snell said there was enough blunt force on Christie's neck to cause those wounds. She experienced a strangulation. The jury heard this testimony and the testimony of the defense experts. They deemed Dr. Kenneth Snell's testimony reliable.
And so even though the jury may not have accepted that that was sufficient evidence of premeditated design, your view is that that evidence would nevertheless support the element of second degree that requires an act that's imminently dangerous that evinces a depraved mind?
Certainly, Your Honor. Look to the teachings of McCarran. There, the defendant pointed a firearm at the victim. And then he pulled the trigger. So you have two parts, essentially. The imminently dangerous act and the depraved mind. The imminently dangerous act being pointing a loaded weapon at someone and the depraved mind of pulling the trigger. Now here, you can apply the same analyses. The first part is Harif wrapping his hands around Christie's neck and squeezing. Dr. Kenneth Snell said she would have been unconscious within 10 to 15 seconds. And the depraved mind? Well, Dr. Kenneth Snell said it takes 3 to 5 minutes for someone to pass while being strangled. So Harif squeezed Christie's neck continuously, applying pressure for 3 to 5 minutes.
Was there any evidence of a struggle at the scene?
No, Your Honor, there was no direct evidence of a struggle at the scene. But the jury heard all the circumstantial evidence surrounding this event. And as we know, direct and circumstantial evidence have no distinction. Now, the court also determined that the other acts evidence to which Kristen Wallace, Marissa Bridges, and Melvin Vosica testified was not cumulative. I think you've heard my friend's other argument. They're not really challenging whether the other acts evidence was relevant. It's really for a purpose other than character evidence. They're arguing the 403 analysis. So we kind of have to remember where are we at in the procedural, the balancing test of 404B. Once it's found to be relevant, as this court has said, the balance tips emphatically towards admission. And the jury was instructed that it may take in consideration any domestic relationship that existed between the accused and the person killed. The testimony of these witnesses wasn't cumulative. We're missing pieces of the puzzle. Look at the testimony of Kristen Wallace. 2 weeks prior to Christie's death, she's not herself. She's not upbeat. And yes, she told Kristen that, "I think Chance is drugging me." Look at the testimony of Marissa Bridges. She was the one that put the baby monitor in that room. And she also testified to a distinct event of Hera slamming her head into a door. Finally, Melvin. When asked, when he knew of the physical abuse, and he asked Christie, why don't you call law enforcement? They can take care of it. Christie responded, "I think he would kill me once he got out." So it's the state's position that this evidence wasn't cumulative. And the court, as a gatekeeper of that evidence, really set the line that a state could not cross. It excluded several statements it desired to offer into evidence. It excluded the testimony of one of the state's witnesses at trial, Aaron Cole. And certainly it provided the cautionary instruction, whether how many times.
Did the court provide an instruction concerning the proper use of the other acts evidence?
I'm sorry, could you clarify, Your Honor?
Did the court in final instructions provide an instruction to the jury that told the jury how to treat the other acts evidence?
Certainly, Your Honor.
They did?
Yes.
They did.
Okay. If this court has no more questions.
Are you completed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, well, no one's ever chastised for quitting early. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Hansman, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Ms. Hansman, I'm sorry to have a question right out of the gate, but I might lose my train of thought if I don't ask it. So instruction number 42 is the instruction that I just asked Mr. Kierstead about. And that's an instruction that tells the jury that record before them contains other acts. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But it tells them how they can use that evidence. And among other things, the judge, judge gives this instruction, says, "You may not consider this evidence as tending to show in any other respect the defendant's guilt of the offense." So this is telling the jury how to use the 404B evidence. And your concern, of course, is there's too much of it in there. Our cases say, generally, juries are presumed to follow the instructions that they're given. This instruction was given. Is there something in the record that would suggest that they didn't follow it?
Our position would be that at the point where we have so much other acts evidence in the record, any instruction to the jury isn't going to be enough. And that's not the jury's fault. It's the danger of that evidence coming in that creates the situation of encouraging people to make a decision based upon who somebody is rather than the charges of them.
So in order to accept, if we were to accept your argument, what do we have to create in our decisional law an exception, a carve-out to the general proposition that juries are presumed to follow their instructions? It would accommodate a case like this.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. What we're asking for today is that the rules of evidence, all the rules of evidence, be properly enforced. When you look at the chapter on evidence, on relevance, the title of the chapter is Relevance and Its Limits. Our case is about enforcing those limits.
No, I understand that, but I just have a very specific question about what we do with this instruction, which says this is how you use it.
I understand that, Your Honor, and the instruction is fine. Our position would just be that it had already been poisoned. The jury has already been poisoned because of what has gone on in the record.
Okay.
To address some of what the state has brought up, they spent a considerable amount of time walking through the facts of this case, focusing on Chance Harif as a bad actor. This is just in furtherance of what our point is, that it became a case about who he was as a person, and the offenses charged were secondary. I believe the court's biggest concern here is harmless error. What is the big deal? And the big deal for Chance Harif is what happened to his fair trial rights. If this court were to rule that the introduction of cumulative other acts evidence, which is best characterized as prohibited propensity evidence, improper character evidence, as it lays out in 404A. If that were to be the court's holding, that would impair, that would destroy Chance Harif's constitutional right to a fair trial, as well as all South Dakota citizens' right to a fair trial. For this court to say consistently that that sort of evidence isn't appropriate, but here in a homicide case, a top-tier offense with the most severe of consequences, that here it's harmless error, creates an immense constitutional violation, not just for my client, but for everyone.
So how do we look at this then? Do we review this as an abuse of discretion evidentiary issue, or is the constitutional question preeminent, and we review that de novo?
You'd start with the abuse of discretion, that it was arbitrary and unreasonable for the trial court to allow the testimony of Kristen Wallace, Melvin Vosica, and Marissa Bridges to testify to the same incidents already in the record.
I see.
And that is that abuse of discretion results in the constitutional violation of Mr. Harif's fair trial rights. There's no further, go ahead.
So this would need to be a case-by-case assessment. You would agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you distinguish State versus Huber? State versus Huber, just for a few words of background, Huber was charged and convicted with shooting death of his wife, and he argued that he was prejudiced by the introduction of approximately 50 out-of-court statements, and the court found that although voluminous, they were not unfairly prejudicial as they showed the volatile nature of the relationship. How would you distinguish that case from the present matter?
From the present matter, we're not dealing with a volume case. Now, is it our position that there was a lot that came in? Absolutely. But we're not here saying that because of the amount, it went too far. Our position is the substance of what was in that testimony, which was just a repeat. It wasn't evidence that added probative value. It didn't provide the jury with additional relationship context. Where in Huber, we have the situation of a 14-year up-and-down marriage. Those 50 statements span that entire 14-year period, all sorts of different incidents, lots of up and down. Here, we have a relationship that's approximately a year. And the statements that came in through Galen, Barry, and Samantha York are then simply repeated at the end of the state's case in chief by Melvin, Marissa, and Kristen Wallace. That's the difference here. We don't have a bunch of different instances here in Harif. We have a repetition of the same. That would be the difference between Huber's case and the Harif case. No further questions. We would ask that this...
I know. I was just going to thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Your Honor. We'd ask that the conviction be vacated and this matter remanded for a new trial.
Thank you, Counsel. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.